Hi, I'm Rick Outzen, publisher and owner of InWeekly, Pensacola, Florida's alt-weekly newspaper, and the author of the Walker Holmes books, City of Grudges and Blood in the Water. And this is And the Murders Began. These podcasts are conversations with best-selling authors and journalists about their craft. This episode features R.G. Belinsky. Dick Belinsky comes from the highly competitive world of New York City tabloids. As a former metropolitan editor of the New York Post, managing editor of the New York Daily News, news editor of Star Magazine, and most recently was the managing editor for news at NBCNews.com, Dick has been involved in some of the biggest news stories of the past three decades, including Son of Sam and the O.J. Simpson murder trial. Dick has created two series built around female journalists. Under the name Dana Perry, he has written two thrillers, The Silent Victim and The Golden Girl, in which the protagonist is a newspaper reporter, Jesse Tucker. The other series, written under R.G. Belsky, features Claire Carlson, a TV journalist in New York City. All three books, Yesterday's News, Below the Fold, and The Last Scoop, have won awards. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did.
Tell us about some of the big stories that you worked on with newspapers, and I know there are tons of them.
Well, yeah. So I've been in not just journalism, but I've been in mostly New York City tabloid journalism for most of my life, and that really extends back to started in the 70s. So yeah, there's been a few big crime stories during those times for the kind of publications that gave it the maximum coverage. And so still probably the biggest and the first when I was very young was Son of Sam. You know, so I was there at the New York Post in the middle of, you know, the summer of Sam in New York City. And I've done a number of books that involve serial killers in them. And in The Last Scoop, the Claire Carlson book that's out now, you know, is inspired many ways by a, you know, Son of Sam and a serial killer, but the serial killers are different. Like, we can talk about The Last Scoop a little bit later, but it's a totally different kind of a serial killer. But the peg of the book is that no one knows that serial killers out there, because we think of serial killers as like Son of Sam, writing notes to the press and blood is in the streets and I'm going to take another victim tomorrow and all that. And we see that in the movies. We see it in Dirty Harry and all the everything. But the reality is with Son of Sam is for, I think, probably close to the first year, no one knew he was killing anybody, you know, because he had shot and killed several women. But nobody put it together. Nobody connected it because they were different places. I mean, nobody thought, oh, there's a serial killer out there. And it wasn't until, I guess it was about 6 months before he was finally caught, that they did a ballistics thing that determined that the same gun had probably been used in several killings. And then suddenly it's, oh my gosh, there's a serial killer out there. And that's when the story exploded on the page one of the Post and page one of the Daily News. And Jimmy Breslin was there, and Steve Dunleavy, and I was the city editor, so I was just in the middle of it, watching it all happen, and playing a bit of a role. So you don't get much bigger than that.
Right.
I think every serial killer has sort of been, since then, has been inspired by Son of Sam. But oh, you know, there's so many others. There's Bernie Getz, a subway shooter. There's the Central Park jogger case, which has taken on all sorts of new controversy in recent years because of the racial overtones.
Right.
There's the Robert Chambers, Jennifer Levin, the Central Park murder of the preppy murder case, which was huge. And then, you know, one huge crime story that you probably have heard of that I covered after I left the Post when I was with Star Magazine is O.J. Simpson. You know, I always, like, look back in that and it's like, my goodness, when you look at that story, I mean, if you were in, like, 1978 when O.J. Simpson was America's hero, you know, he was
right,
the greatest person in the world, and you project it and say, oh, this is all going to happen, this is going to happen, and there's going to be the trial of the century. I mean, you couldn't have written a book like that. And I basically spent 2 years of my life, you know, helping to cover the O.J. case. That, it just got to be one of the most unique crimes ever.
Gosh, really, and kept the whole nation's attention through all the trial, and he was such an all-American hero.
I'll give you one little footnote, which is an author footnote, that if you look on Amazon or even in some library still, there is a book called O.J. Simpson, America's Superstar, that was written in 1977 by someone named Dick Belsky. And it was like one of these quickie books for, like, kids, you
right,
know, sports books. And in it, I wax eloquently about what a wonderful human being O.J. Simpson is. He's everything America looks for in a hero and everything. And it's I don't want to say it's funny, but it's you look at it now and you're like, but, you know, as I tell people, you know, I wasn't the only person he fooled.
Right,
I mean, he fooled an awful lot of people back then.
Yeah, I publish an all-weekly in Pensacola, and a tabloid, and everyone loves a good headline. And I think that the standard by which many of us measure our headlines is one that was published in the New York Times in April 1983.
Let's get this right. Not the New York Times.
New York Post.
New York Times would never have written that headline.
Published in the New York Post.
I would have got fired for that headline in the New York Times.
I'm sorry. Published in the New York Post in April 1983. Headless body and topless bar.
Tell us the story behind
that headline.
That's probably the most famous thing I've ever been involved with in my entire journalistic career. And I always say, you know, like, I've been in this a long time. I've done a lot of stuff. I think I've made some pretty decent accomplishments as a journalist. But if you Google Dick Belsky and New York Post or whatever journalist, probably the thing that comes up most with me is headless body and topless bar. And I've been asked about this over the years. I've written about it. I wrote a long piece for NBC about it when I was working at NBC News about the phenomenon. I've done other things about it. And the interesting thing is, like, I didn't write that headline, but I have been associated with it. And was it Woody Allen that had the line about the biggest part of life is just showing up, you know, and that's kind of what I did. Is I showed up in the newsroom that day, and I was the city editor, and the managing editor was a man named Vincent Musetto, and he became legendary for running all sorts of crazy, wild tabloid headlines, but that was the one he became the most famous for. And we started around, it must have been around 6 or 7, it was about 6 in the morning, like, we walked in, and, like, really early, and he walks over to me and he said, oh, there was this murder overnight in a bar, and somebody cut the victim's head off. And it was this really strange story, because the guy tries to hold up the bar, and then the bartender resists, and he shoots him dead. And one of the customers in the bar is like a mortician, and he, you know, the guy uses her whatever to cut off the head. But it makes no sense, you know, because like a crazy little crime in a rundown bar in Queens. And apparently he thought his bullet would be in the head, so if he took the head, you know, well, that makes sense. You know, I'll take the head with me, and then, you know, and so they catch him actually later with the head anyway. But the bottom line is, it's what, you know, it's one of those crimes that, you know, it's just really low, like a low, you know, not the kind of crime you normally would put on page one. It was just weird. And it could have just been like a two-paragraph weird thing in the paper, but the editor, you know, said, I've got this great idea for a headline, Headless Body and Topless Bar. But the only problem was, we didn't know if it was the topless bar, because he didn't say topless bar, or there was no advertising or anything like that. But somebody had claimed, oh, I think there's topless dancing there. So my assignment, my goal was, I had to determine if indeed it was a topless bar so that we could run that headline. And, you know, you forget, a lot of people forget how, well, journalism, but also the world, was in 1983. You didn't Google anything. You didn't look it up online. There were no news channels. Like, you know, I think CNN had just started. You got your news from the newspaper or maybe a TV broadcast in the evening. It was very hard to get information. You know, kids today don't understand. You can't just go online and find it.
Right.
So we did everything the old school. I mean, we made phone calls. We called the police. We talked to everybody. And nobody knew about it being a topless bar. No, never heard that. Never heard anything about it being a topless bar. And so we couldn't run the headline unless we knew that. And eventually, I sent a young woman reporter out there. Her name is Marilyn Matlick, and she's become part of the story too. She calls and she said, look, I'm standing out here, it's closed, it's shut, it's noon, there's nobody around, there's no signs of anything about topless, nothing. And she then, you know, because reporters, you know, have a lot of ingenuity, she said, let me try something. And she went around to the back of that bar, crawled up on a garbage can and looked in this grimy, dirty window into the bar, and she saw a sign that said, topless dancing tonight. And, you know, that was it. Journalistic history was made. And so that story has, like, followed me, you know, and I'm happy about it, you know, through my entire career. And again, like, I was really just there, you know. I was the fact checker. I was the guy that had to get the fact that it was topless. And, you know, that headline, oh, my God, there's T-shirts.
Right.
There's a movie called Headless Body. I think it was in the opening credits of Saturday Night Live for a while, you know, so.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, the transition from journalist and editor to mystery writer, what did you learn as a journalist and editor that's helped you be a good mystery writer?
Well, you know, a lot. I mean, obviously, you learn how to write a story, because all stories are the same, whether it's a novel or a 10-inch police story. You learn how to write a story. You learn how to make deadlines. You learn how to accumulate information. I would defer to someone a lot more successful and even than me in Michael Connelly. So Michael Connelly, you know, was a crime reporter at the Los Angeles Times before he became Michael Connelly, best-selling author of Harry Bosch and, you know, all the others, the Lincoln Lawyer. I've interviewed him a couple times, and we've talked about our journalism backgrounds, and I asked him about, that's the same question you're asking me, and his answer, which, you know, I think I would agree with, was that if I hadn't been a journalist, I would never have been an author. In other words, that was the necessary step for him to write novels, was for him first to be a journalist, because, I mean, you know, from journalism, I mean, journalism teaches you an awful lot about an awful lot of things in life, and it's, you know, it's a great profession, and yeah, so much of what I write in the novels is based on stuff that I learned, you know, as a journalist.
Yeah, I think that's what's happened with me, is that, you know, explaining Pensacola, Florida, which is where my books are based, to editors in New York was a challenge. Sometimes I had to send them photos or links to stories I'd written so that they would believe it was true.
Yeah.
It actually happened that way.
Well, you know, the other thing, and this is like a real basic lesson of writing, probably like me, 99% of your friends, especially people in journalism, all talk about how they want to write a novel. You know, they're all, I'm going to write a novel one day. So an awful lot of people talk about writing a novel, but most of them never do. You know, they don't sit down and do it. And that is one of the things you learn really as a journalist, which is to just sit your butt in the chair, look at the blank screen and do it, because you don't have an option. You know, you don't, you know, you have a deadline that you have to get this story by 6 o'clock, or whatever it is you got to put it together. And that, that mindset really helps me a lot as an author too, because I there are many mornings I am like, I don't know what I want to say, but I sort of act like a journalist, and I sit at the screen, or I sit with my legal pad, which is what I tend to write on, and I basically just say, okay, I've got a deadline, I want to write something in the next 2 hours, and I do it. And that's journalism training.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's funny, because I'll have people suggest they've got an idea for a column for my newspaper, and typically everyone has, well, not everyone, but most people have maybe one good column in them, but then after that they don't know, you know, and then you explain to them, you know, these are the deadlines, this is how it needs to be done. Write me 3 or 4 columns.
Right.
And then I know if you can do it. But it's you're right. Looking at that blank page and knowing that you got to have meet deadline, meet word count, you know, all those things.
You don't wait for inspiration when you're a journalist. You just do it. And another thing with deadlines, I mean, that's been so many authors, they're like, oh, I have trouble, you know, I have to have deadline in a year or whatever. And, you know, I've had authors, I mean, deadlines to me are easy, and because that means I have something to shoot for. And, you know, I've had things where somebody will say, do you think you could have it done by January, you know, and I'll be like, I can have it done by July if you want it. Tell me when you want it, you know, because that's the journalist in me.
Right. Now, let's talk about Claire Carlson in July.
Yeah, I just wanted to say one more thing on the topic of trance, because I know we had talked earlier and you had said one of the things is the difficulties, and this is something that I found really interesting, that when I, in other words, okay, well, how does being a journalist hurt you as an author? The problem with being a journalist is you tell the story very fast. The problem is when you're an author, you can't, especially if it's a mystery, you can't tell the story
right
as. So I spent my whole career, you know, basically trying to put all the facts on the lead and the rest of it in a 12-inch story, you know. And, you know, if you put all your facts in the first page of a mystery, you don't have a mystery. And, I mean, obviously you don't do that, but when I started writing mysteries, I would go from A to B too quickly, you know, because that was my training.
Right.
And so one of the things I had to learn, which is the opposite of what a lot of authors do probably, is I had to learn to slow down. You know, I mean, this isn't journalism. You need to take a breath. You need to bring in other elements. You need to not just go in a straight path. As a journalist, that's sometimes hard to do.
Yeah, I had a hard time with tense. I'm just so used,
yeah,
you know, it's present or near past, so I had a real hard time, and the same kind of thing with time in a novel. Because you're right, it's last week, or it's next week, or it's today, or yesterday. So those simple things of writing that I struggled with trying to get straight in my head, that was a challenge for me.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there are novels in the present tense, and some are excellent. I mean, like Presumed Innocent is written in the entire book in the present tense, and I've tried to do that, but, you know, generally I try not to do tricks like that. I try and do, try and do it in. Now, you want to get into, and I think we're going to talk about this with Claire, but then one of the things that I've always struggled with is, what person do you write a book in? You write it first person, you write it third person, you write it multi-viewpoint, or there even be occasion where you write it second person, that's always a, and that's a decision you kind of got to make at the beginning of the book.
Right, yeah, particularly when you're doing a series. I write mine in first person, too, and I kind of like that ability for the reader to get in the head of the narrator. How about you?
I've tried. So every one of my novels, every one, and I've written, I think, about 15 that have been published, and I got a couple more coming out. So it's pretty extensive, and they've all been written in the first person. But that doesn't mean I haven't written. I mean, I've written a number of other novels in either multi-viewpoint or third person, but for whatever reason, they never got published. And, I feel like I write better in first person, that it's stronger, and I like reading first person when I'm reading other people's books. I understand the you're not able to sort of get into the bad guy's head so much if you're doing, third person. But, I mean, just for instance, the Claire Carlson series, with The Last Scoop, the current book is the third in the series. But the first book, Yesterday's News, was originally written in the third person, not only because Claire is a woman, but because the plot of that one involves some things about her being a woman. And I had originally written it, with a different name, too, but I'd also written it in the third person. Basically, I had a version of it, and then I went back and I changed it to first person, and I just thought it just came across as bit more powerful, and right after that it won the Claymore Award at Killer Nashville and then got published. So I guess I made the right decision, but that's always I think about that a lot, first person, but in the end I generally wind up doing first person.
I like that the reader gets to know that the protagonist isn't perfect, and they get on the kind of tapes that play in all of our heads, that all the things, the self-doubts and those things. It's easier to do it that way, and then the public doesn't, the other characters don't necessarily know what's going on in the protagonist's head, and I like I like that conflict.
I do too. I find obviously there are third person books. I mean, an interesting author story about a person. So a number of years ago, back in the 90s when he had just started writing all his bestsellers, I wound up having a drink at the bar with Michael Conley, and he had, I think, just written The Last Coyote and Bloodwork and all these, the poet, these great books, but his main character was Harry Bosch, and Harry Bosch is interesting because, almost all the great PIs or police people in books are first person, Marlowe with Raymond Chandler, Spencer, with Robert B. Parker, it's always first person, Ross McDonald, Lou Archer. And Harry Bosch, really, especially in the beginning, they were all about Harry Bosch, and they should have been written in the first, you would have thought they were written in the first person, but he wrote all of them except one book in the third person. And I asked him, I was like, and I would spend hours thinking about this, and I said, I thought I'd get this brilliant answer, why did you do it that way? And he just looked at me and he kind of shrugged and went, gee, I don't know, I never thought about it. and that is the brilliance of Michael Conley. Right. He just wrote what he felt,
Well, how would you describe Claire Carlson? You've written three books on her. All of them have been very successful.
Yeah.
How would you describe her to our
listeners? Well, she basically personifies so many women in the media that I worked with over the years at the New York Post and New York Daily News and Star and even at NBC, which is that, she is a tremendous, she's really smart. She's very, I think, funny and, sarcastic and, got a big mouth. She's totally dedicated to her job. She's, tremendous integrity and all these wonderful things. but in terms of her personal life, she's kind of a train wreck. You know, she's been married 3 times. She says the wrong things to people. Her life's kind of a mess. And again, this is based on, I mean, men as well as women, but because I work with a lot of terrific women in the media, I mean, I've discovered in life, it's very hard to kind of have it all. You know, like, I mean, there's always the thing like, oh, the person's a great journalist, they have a great marriage, they have a great family, they're a great mother, you know, they do charity work, you know, that, you know, a lot of those people don't exist. Most people, you give up something, you know, right. You give up your parts of your career for your personal life, or what I've found a lot is people basically, you know, sacrifice their personal life for the job. And that's really an awful lot of what Claire does. Now, having said that, that's important when you're writing it because, I mean, let's just say Claire could do it all. You know, she had a wonderful, happy life, and she was a great journalist and all this stuff. She wouldn't be a very interesting character because we don't really want to read about that. And a guy I know pretty well, I've gotten to know pretty well on some panels and stuff, Reed Farrell Coleman, who writes actually had until recently been writing the Robert Parker Jesse Stone series, was talking about it at a panel, and I thought this sums it up when you're trying to write your character. And he said that writing Jesse Stone was one of the, you know, when he had to take it over for after Parker died, that it was a very difficult character to write. And I was like, well, why? He said, because he's perfect. I mean, he's got so many positive things. I mean, first off, when you think of Jesse Stone, you think of Tom Selleck playing him on TV.
Right.
You know, like, how could it go wrong? He's tough, he's good looking, he's honest, you know, he's everything, you know. And Reed said, you know, the trick is you need to find the flaws, and the flaws are okay. He drinks. The drinking has affected his career. He's got a marriage. He loves his wife, but she, you know, they're broken up. He had a baseball career, but it was ruined with an injury at the last time. And I think almost all good authors, whether it be Chandler or Connelly or you know, Sue Grafton with Kinsey Malone, you need, and this is certainly what I try to do, is to create that character who is like really admirable on many ways, but also, when you're reading it, you're going, oh, my God,
right.
You know, what a mess she is, or he is.
Right, right. They almost need an intervention, you know, at some point.
Yeah, we don't like perfect people.
No.
We like flawed people, yeah.
Now, Claire Carlson is not the only newspaper reporter you've used as a protagonist. You've created Jesse Tucker and have 2 books by her under
right.
a different
so,
name.
Yeah, so this gets even more confusing with the R.G. Belsky thing. But I'm currently writing another series under the name Dana Perry. And they're thrillers. They're much more even thrillers than the Claire Carlson books, which are more suspense. They're actually for a British publisher called Bookership, but they're very very available here in the States. I mean, and most of it is online and audio. And the first one is called The Silent Victim, and the second one is called The Golden Girl. And that features a newspaper reporter named Jesse Tucker. You know, I'm one of those people. I tend to write about what I know, and it's a little hard for me to write about being a lawyer or something, because
right.
One of the great things about being a writing about a newsroom, and like, so look, I worked at NBC News, but I've never worked in a local TV station newsroom
right.
per se, but I've worked in newsrooms. So what I'm conveying in Claire's thing is what a newsroom is like, as you know, I mean, a lot of it is TV too, but it's just this idea of a newsroom. And I mean, if I was writing about somebody who was you know, an accountant or something, I don't know, that would require a lot more research, and so I've always tended to write about what I know. Number one, because I think it's somebody can read my book and say they don't like it, but I don't think they can say, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right,
you know?
Right. Right. The Last Scoop is the book that, yeah, your latest Claire Carlson book is published in May. There's a mm-hmm. line in it that just, for me being a journalist and investigative reporter, just sticks out. It's under the rules according to Claire, and it says, you know, I am a woman who deals in lies for a living.
It's actually the first sentence of the book.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, I believe very strongly in this idea that you want to hook the reader from the first line, because
right.
somebody's going to pick up the book and they're going to look at it. And I like to think there are people like you who read that line and go, wow, I want to keep reading.
Right.
You know? I try not to start books with, like, you know, like the description of the sky or the weather or something. I know, look, many good books that do, but I just, I try and this is my journalistic training, I think, I just try and hit them with something that grabs them and kind of conveys the feel of it. And I think I had written that line about something else at one point, but I always it was stuck in my mind. And so when I when I was writing this, I just you know, and because, and look, that's so much of what, you know, so much of what journalism is lies and exposing lies and telling the truth. And the reason you're telling the truth is because not everybody's telling the truth. So, I mean, it can be the ultimate, like something like Watergate, which is exposing lies. But you tend to do it in little ways every day. I mean, if you're covering a police story and the police aren't giving you the whole story, then you need to find out the whole story. And so there's lies. Some of them aren't malicious lies, but you know, the whole idea of being a journalist obviously is to tell the truth.
Right, to discern what the truth is. Yeah, for sure.
And Claire, like a lot of mystery characters who are PIs or whatever, is not above breaking the rules to do that, because sometimes you can't follow all the rules. So she'll break into something or steal something or something in the same way that, you know, Philip Marlowe would break the law or somebody else. You know, again, if a character follows the rule of the law all the way, that tends to be not terribly interesting.
Well, that leads into my last question. Who are some of the writers that inspire you in your writing?
Yeah, well, you know, it's always tough because you leave people out, but there's sort of, I'm one of those people who doesn't, I don't sample a lot. I mean, I do, you know, I do some reviewing and things and do some interviews, so I do wind up reading people I hadn't read before. But I'm one of those people that when I get a character, you know, I just read it all. So, I mean, it started with, in the 70s, I'd never thought about writing a mystery novel, but it started in the 70s because I picked up, like many mystery writers, I picked up Raymond Chandler and I read The Big Sleep, and I went, oh, wow, this is cool. I'd like to write a book like this. And I actually found I wrote a short story called Find the Girl, which I found the other day when I was going through some stuff, which was my first attempt to be Raymond Chandler-esque, you know. And actually, some of it wasn't bad. There are not a lot of Chandlers to read. There are only basically 7 books. Then I got into all sorts of other stuff. I started reading, I read all the Ross McDonald's, Lou Archer. It's a great, tremendously underrated series if you haven't read them. I mean, he's like Chandler. It's just not quite as over the top, but still that Southern California PI stuff. I then went the other way, and I read every Agatha Christie, which seems kind of weird, but I got really into Agatha Christie. And then I discovered, you know, Spencer with Robert B. Parker, and I've read every Spencer that's ever been written, from all the Parker ones until the current ones that are being done by Ace Atkins. And then after that, I guess in the early 90s, I became this huge Michael Connelly fan. So I've read every Michael Connelly book, you know, that has ever been. Okay, we're talking about 40 books. So those are the main, but then there's so many others along the way. I mean, Stu Grafton, Dennis Lehane, I mean, Mystic River, some of those are just amazing. I read a lot of Mary Higgins Clark because even though I don't write like Mary Higgins Clark, the way she would, you know, kind of put the pieces together of a puzzle, you know, kind of like a murder, you know, I found fascinating. So they always say, I mean, you can't be a writer without reading. And I try and read people that, you know, that I admire, you know, that I can kind of, that I can try and be that kind of a writer. But, you know, look, it started with Raymond Chandler, and no one's ever going to be Raymond Chandler again, but so many mystery authors, when you ask them, they'll say, oh, yeah, Raymond Chandler was the first, and that certainly was the case.
And that's sort of, as I started doing these podcasts, that's what comes up a lot. And Agatha Christie gets mentioned a lot because she teaches you how to write a puzzle. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, like 10 Little Indians. And then you still talk about the murder of Roger Ackroyd, because she broke all the rules of that by hitting you with a cheat out of left field at the end. You know?
Right.
And I'd say it's a spoiler, but if you haven't read, I think the murder of Roger Ackroyd was written in 1927. So if you haven't read it yet, you're probably not going to read it. she hits you at the end with the fact that the guy who you've been listening to the whole time really did the murder. And there was a huge, you know, there was a huge thing. It's like, oh, that's not playing fair. But I mean, that's the great thing is, like, you just come out of a field. But and then, you know, Sue Grafton, I got a chance to meet her at, you know, wonderful woman. And she was really admirable, too, because, I mean, she and Sarah Paretsky, and I've talked to Sarah Paresky too. They really were at the forefront of the emergence of like women mystery writers, mm-hmm. you know, in the '80s. You know, because to that point there weren't that many, and mostly it was men, and that led, of course, later to Janet Ivanovich and a lot of the others. But you know, Sue Grafton was a fascinating woman, and she also was one of these people who had great admiration for the mystery as a craft. I mean, you know, a lot of people go like, oh, well, you're only writing a mystery. Why don't you write a real novel, you know? She talked about that at, it might have been a Killer Nashville, actually, I was at. She was at one of the conferences I was at, and she says, people always tell me I should be, like, writing a real book instead of a mystery. And she's like, I've tried to read a real book, you know, like a novel that's not a mystery, and I just keep turning the page and saying, okay, when is something going to happen? And I think that's, for those of us who like suspense and mysteries, that's how we feel. We like books where things are happening.
Right. Thank you so much for doing this interview. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to And the Murders Began. To learn more about Dick Belsky and his writing, visit rgbelsky.com. To find out about Walker Holmes and his Pensacola, check out rickoutson.com. Again, thank you for listening.